This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Hey, listeners, we're trying something new this year. Come join us live on Tuesday, August 13th from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern. And we will take questions and stories from you, our listeners.
Maybe you have a question for one of our previous guests or even about the episode you're listening to today. Do you have a question for us or a great what is your why story? Either way, we want to hear it.
So call in and we'll address your questions and we'll include them in our final episode of the season. And if you can't call on August 13th, automated operators are standing by right now. Send us a voicemail on our SpeakPipe or an email, and all of our contact info will be below.
Can't wait to hear from you.
Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to CDP's Practical for Your Practice podcast. I'm Corinne Lefkowitz, joined today by my friend and colleague, Kevin Holloway. How are you doing,
hey,
Kevin?
Hey, Corinne. I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good. I am pretty excited about today's episode because we've got a guest from my original workplace.
Ooh.
From the Michael J. Crescent's VA Medical Center out in Philadelphia, which is where I started my career with military-connected folks. And
I think you mentioned a little bit about that in the first episode of the season, right?
Yeah. And although I want to hear all the ins and outs of what's going on at my VA, I guess it's more important that we introduce our guest and talk about today's topic, which is going to be on using EBPs within substance use disorders clinics. And in that regard, we have Dr. Mark Campanile with us today. Hello, Mark. Thank you for being with us.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're thrilled to.
Very excited.
Yeah. Thank you for continuing all the good work that I know is happening down at the Philadelphia VA. I thought we could start today by having you tell us, introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about what you do. And as we're doing this season, also why you do it, what brings you into this field and why do you do what you do?
Sure. So I'm a psychologist at the Philadelphia VA. I'm also the program manager for our addiction recovery unit, which is the specialty clinic that treats the substance use presentations, both as its own specialty clinic. So we carry our own caseloads. We also consult with the rest of our colleagues in the mental health clinics, supporting them with groups and other adjunctive treatments for their veterans who also use substances. And the why is a tricky thing. I'll be honest and say I fell into it at first, right? It was just the first job that I was really able to get. I started off doing evaluations in the justice system. Assessments and writing up reports. I think it kind of developed from there a few different avenues, but I was lucky enough to have a really good training in substance use when I was on internship, and then a postdoc that focused on the intersection of our geriatric populations, substance use, chronic pain, and PTSD. Mm. Just a small thing to focus on there during postdoc, and did that here with the Philadelphia VA for a year. And I really found that there's just the substance use component is still one of those groups. Folks who are struggling with this are still one of those groups that face a lot of stigma, face a lot of justice, and that a lot of clinicians just don't really feel that comfortable working with.
Right? Which is, of course, one of the reasons we're having you on, because, we think a lot of folks, ourselves included, maybe that's not something that we have as a primary expertise. But shows up so often in a lot of the presentations of the folks we do see. So we're really glad to have you here talking about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about when you are working within the ARU and with folks with substance use issues? We know that there's a lot of comorbidity, and that's kind of the rule rather than the exception. Do you notice any trends in your clinic about what the most common comorbidities are with substance use disorders?
I think working at the VA, there's, probably a it's just a population, right? So we do see an awful lot of PTSD. But in connection with that, we'll also see a fair amount of chronic pain and depression and other anxiety disorders kind of follow after that. But the PTSD, I think, is really worth mentioning because there's kind of a tricky relationship there where enough trauma often leads folks to a form of avoidance. An easy one in our society is substance use, right? Especially with alcohol and, kind of being legal and there's no limit to how much you can get and all this. But then the other side of that coin, of course, is that if you're using enough substances, you're often in vulnerable and risky situations that can lead to traumas secondary to the substance. So.
I'm so glad you described that because, as we were talking about before we started recording, Corinne and I are both PTSD instructors for different evidence-based psychotherapies for PTSD. We have a lot of experience treating those. And I'm just thinking back to my internship days. So I did my internship at the Portland, Oregon VA, and this was just, I think, slightly before a lot of like PTSD-focused clinics and substance use disorder clinics were combined. Like back in the day, they were these separate entities. And it was tough because when we'd have a lot of folks in the PTSD clinics, there was a lot of comorbidity with substance use disorders. And sometimes during intake, they were told, well, you definitely have PTSD, but what complicates it is the substance use stuff. And so we're going to send you to the substance use disorder clinic. You get that alcohol under control, and we'll come back in and we'll treat you for the PTSD. And then they'd get to the substance use clinic and they would say, oh, you definitely got a substance use issue going on, but what's complicating it is the PTSD. So we're going to send you to the PTSD clinic, and you get that PTSD under control and come back here and we'll treat you for the alcohol. And it was always seemed to be this, kind of this push and pull of never really finding where's the right place for people
It's
to
like
land.
hot
And
potato. It's like
right,
hot
it's kind of
potato. Yeah.
not our client, not our client. And at least in the meantime, I've heard that since I was there, and it's been many, many years, that there's been an effort to really kind of integrate or consolidate some of these services too, so that folks are being treated concurrently or they're getting care rather than being handed off. So I love that you talked about that, especially with, PTSD being a higher comorbidity, at least in the VA system with substance use.
Absolutely. And not just in the VA system, but I think we do a lot of assessment of PTSD in this system. And, I'll say that to speak to that point, on my team, it's myself and then there are two other psychologists and a LCSW, actually two LCSWs, and we provide the psychotherapy on the team. And amongst us, I want to say there are four of us who are certified in CPT and three in prolonged exposure. Two are currently finishing their training in EMDR,
That's excellent.
and one in STAR, right? So we're very much addressing that same concern you were discussing, where you can't just treat the substance use disorder, you got to know how to also treat the other stuff that comes with it.
That makes me so happy to hear. Like,
Same.
I mean, it wasn't, I feel. That when I was, I remember that when I was at the Philly VA, we were certainly making inroads to get more access in the ways that you're describing. It sounds like that's gotten even better. And that's so nice to hear because I don't think every place can say that. I'm proud. I'm proud of my Philly folks. This is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a really good team here. I'm happy with everybody.
So, it sounds like some of the EBPs that you're utilizing within the ARU are prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, EMDR, STAR. So you've got kind of the PTSD diagnoses covered for sure. Are there any other EBPs that are particularly helpful with comorbidities that you see?
So we also have a handful of folks. I couldn't quote the numbers as easily off the top of my head, but we definitely have folks trained in ACT. In CBT for depression. I think one person is trained in IPT for depression. And there's a lot of insomnia, CBT for insomnia, that's kind of built into the work, although I don't know that any of us are really doing a full protocol of that.
Oh, that's really great. So you are truly covering a lot of different bases, a lot of different common comorbidities with substance use disorders.
And then along with that, then I assume there's also some particular protocols or ways of approaching the substance use as well. So I guess part of my question is two pronged, like what else are y'all doing, and how do you integrate that? How do you make it work so that, you're kind of approaching two things at once and getting some benefit to moving forward? Because I think, as the data tells us, is that concurrent treatment for substance use disorders and trauma, for example, is the way to do it. Like, serial treatment doesn't seem to work. And I imagine in some of these other comorbid conditions, that's similar too.
100%. I mean, I'll start by saying it is certainly challenging work.
Yes.
And I did a year postdoc on it, and I've basically been doing that work since, and still some days have a hard time articulating to interns and postdocs kind of how we're going to approach case presentation. But also at its simplest, there's really kind of the answer that we love to use, which is really meeting the client where they're at. But I can describe it better than that.
Well, good.
So in our clinic, we use cognitive behavioral therapy for substance use disorder, which is a pretty strongly evidence-based treatment. We use motivational interviewing and motivational enhancement therapies.
Yes.
And we're also running a contingency management program that is specific to stimulant use disorders for the moment. So all of those are really direct, modalities that have a lot of evidence behind them that we're using to support folks. And in most instances, I would say are not being used to the exclusion of treatment of the comorbid conditions. You guys mentioned that we can kind of link things in the chat. I will dig up the article, but not long ago, our behavioral health director, Dr. David Oslin, did a research study that focused on kind of integrating motivational interviewing into PE, and kind of how that can change outcomes and that sort of stuff. So I'll get that to you guys later.
No, I appreciate that. Certainly one of the other topics that we teach at CDP is a motivational interviewing workshop. And I think not a lot of the folks who attend perhaps are even aware that motivational interviewing was originally developed to work with folks with substance use disorder. But man, there's so much good overlap between that and how we approach clients with prolonged exposure therapy. And really, I mean, as our instructor for MI here at CDP likes to say, it's not a therapy in and of itself. It's an approach to conversation. It's a really an approach for how you interact with, your clients that is very much kind of eschewing or kind of rejecting like a stigma-based kind of you should be working harder, what is wrong with you kind of approach to a let's talk about what is meaningful to you. Let's think about, where you're at in your journey. And just I love that integration. Even just when I'm working with a PTSD client that doesn't have substance use disorder on board, which is, there's not it's not always the case, but that can be useful across the board. So yeah.
Yeah, I think we use it in a 2 and 3 session model, motivational interviewing and then motivational enhancement therapy. Motivational enhancement therapy is a little bit more specific to the goals around substance use because it uses a tool to kind of identify the costs of substance use and really make those lay them out bare to the patient or to the client and to make them really accessible to talk about what they've cost the person and how they've interfered with their life. And but the motivational interviewing component, even when we're not doing that 2 session model of the interviewing, is very much the spirit that we bring to any of the interventions we're doing, with the approach of just kind of being there with the person and curious about what change might look like and how the, what the next step might be.
I've got a question about that that kind of follows that a little bit. And I have to start by saying it's a question that probably you could take 3 hours to answer. So I and we know this is a short podcast episode, so I apologize. I'm setting you up for failure. But
Maybe this is the extendo episode of this
Extended
season, right?
check-in for extra hidden content. You talk about basically this suite of treatments that you have available for folks based on what they need, right? So a few different approaches to substance use disorder treatment, a few different approaches to PTSD treatment, insomnia work, motivational interviewing, et cetera. You really offer so much. And as you said, you try to meet clients with where they're at and give them what they need. Can you just give us, especially for clinicians who have this question all the time, just a tiny bit of insight as to how you make that decision, how you go about matching up the client with what you think is going to work best for them or what you might offer them?
So I think the first step, so we do a very robust intake, and I would encourage anybody out there who really wants to feel like they know how to approach this stuff to look into ASAM training. It's just what that stands for is just escaping me at the moment. But the ASAM training basically gives you a five-dimensional look at what level of care is going to be appropriate for a client as they present with various different substances that are affecting them across the board, right? How is this integrated into their home life? How is this affecting work? How is it affecting them physically, right? Because, you know, a common thing that folks, you know, a thing that I can remember being taught early in my substance use career is withdrawal from an opiate will feel like you're going to die, but alcohol or benzos could kill you. Right. And so it's kind of these little things that a lot of folks are not going to know off the top of their head. But if you go through this training and you have these criteria in front of you, you can start to get a sense like, hey, maybe this is someone who isn't really going to be treated here in my office. This is someone I'm not going to say, stop drinking. Right. This is someone I'm going to say, we need to get you evaluated medically before we make these changes. Or, you know, you start to look into things like what kind of changes need to be made in the environment to make this more successful and these kinds of things. So it's a really robust evaluation process, and it gives you a good way to look at the more systemic interventions that are going to be needed. And then I think it's the other thing that is most powerful in this is that we take a very harm reduction approach. Thank you, Kevin, the American Society for Addiction Medicine. We take a harm reduction approach in that a lot of folks, you know, in the past, substance use work was, you know, if you're ready to quit, come see us. If you're not, come back when you are. And that's very much not, that's not our approach. If you're thinking about change, we want to talk to you about that thought process. If you're wanting to cut back, we're on board with that goal, and we've got techniques and interventions that'll help with that. And if you're ready to quit, we're on board for that too. And along with that, we have a really strong medical team and our psychiatrists who have all kinds of amazing medication-assisted treatments that will support folks in either cutting back or stopping a substance.
So it sounds like assessment, as common sense as it sounds, is really an integral part of this, really figuring out one, what is the client presenting with? What are their needs? How dangerous, how critical are the substances that they're using and their use? And also assessing what do they want to do? You know, where are they at? How can we meet them where they are and kind of start them on that road to recovery, whatever that's going to look like?
Absolutely. And I think another component of it often is education. I mean, it's shocking how many folks come into our office and just in the screening with their primary care doctor, they're already kind of in the 90th percentile for consumption of alcohol. And when the primary care doctor says, hey, I think you might have a problem with alcohol, they're like, well, all my buddies drink the same amount. Right. So being able to just kind of sit across from somebody after having this really robust conversation and asking questions that bring to light the different places their substance use has affected their life opens the door to some accessibility to getting started with change.
You mentioned medication assisted therapy too, and which has always fascinated me. Like on the one hand, it's kind of like, well, of course, right? The medication assisted therapy makes a lot of sense when somebody is struggling with addiction to substances. And but at the same time, I don't know that a lot of folks who don't work in a substance use clinic or substance use, kind of on their day-to-day work, are familiar with or kind of know what are some of those medications, what are they used for. And I don't know that I'm asking you to give us like a rundown and a list, but like maybe some examples of that, just so that our listeners get a sense for like what is that.
I mean, I think there's my favorite example is a medication called naltrexone. And this is where I will use my disclaimer. I'm not a physician. And so I'm explaining to you what I've seen in work with the veterans that I see and in collaboration with the psychiatrists we have here at the Philadelphia VA. But naltrexone's a wonderful medication for folks who either want to stop or cut back on alcohol. Unlike antabuse, where you take the medication and if you consume alcohol, you're going to throw up. Naltrexone really quiets down cravings and urges to drink alcohol, which is a awesome effect that helps folks to just reduce how much they're using over time or to quit entirely. But the other effect that's really powerful from this is that it'll also quiet the part of your brain that folks commonly experience where once I've had two drinks, six seems like a better idea, right? And so for a lot of folks taking naltrexone, what they'll see is they just drink less when they choose to drink, right? So instead of having 10 beers at a wedding and embarrassing themselves, they have four and have a good time. Another example that I can't understate is Suboxone or Sublocade, which is an opiate medication that that acts in two ways. One, it provides a little opiate agonist, which allows a person not to feel withdrawal symptoms. But it also provides a bit of a block, right? And this prevents folks from being able to get as high and to get a high off it or abuse it in the same ways that they might a full agonist opioid. And so it's a medication that both helps people deal with the withdrawal symptoms and the cravings and this kind of stuff with a lower risk of abuse. And then when you switch over to the Sublocade, which is an injectable, now you can kind of have coverage for a 30-day window that you don't have to worry about. Did I lose my medications? If you're living in a high-risk environment, they didn't get stolen from me, that kind of stuff.
I really appreciate the way that you're describing kind of the flexibility of options that are available. Because it's a really great way to illustrate that we've moved beyond what we used to do, which is, well, if you're not going to be sober, you can't have treatment. That's your option, right? There's flexibility in meeting clients where they are, which makes the treatment all that much more effective. That said, go back to your our kind of original point of discussion, which is many of us, myself included, as a clinician, feel immediately anxious when we start talking about this stuff, feel immediately ill prepared to kind of have these discussions with clients or to know what to recommend or to even work with this. So this question might naturally lead us into our actionable intel segment, but I'm curious, Mark, since you've been doing this for a while, what suggestions would you give to clinicians who maybe want to be less afraid of this and more willing to take this on? Because we need, frankly, more providers who can do this work. How do people like myself get started and get more comfortable with this?
I mean, I think anyone who has an interest in this area, a really great place to start is with some training in motivational interviewing or motivational enhancement therapy. The motivational enhancement therapy is going to be more specific to the substance use disorders, but it'll also offer a little bit more insight into kind of the directions you can go and what the assessment looks like. But both of them provide the framework of a curious approach. What questions to ask and what reflections to make to really deepen the understand the, the presenting problem of a substance use disorder. I would also add to that that I think that there's just some good public health materials and I can send some of those over to you guys as
That would be
well
great,
after we talk that that are just really accessible, right? The one that I'm thinking of kind of outlines the safe drinking limits, right? And so they're different for men and women and by age group, but in general, what we talk about with folks is that in a given day, you want to make sure you're drinking, for a man, drinking four or less standard alcoholic drinks, right? So that'd be one beer of about, 5% or a shot that's 45 proof. So you're drinking four or less in any given day, right, to protect your liver. And then in a given week, you want to be at 14 or less, right? And if we can work within that, so you can't save up your four all week long and have a big Saturday. But if you're staying in those limits, you're generally in a safer position, right? It's one less each for women or folks who are over 65. So it'd be three drinks in a day, and I think it's 12 a week for women. But I can send those materials over.
That would be
But just
fantastic.
having some of those talking points to be able to kind of be like, hey, listen, this is where you're at. This is what is recommended medically. What do you think about that? Is really the first place to start.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. And I mean, like you said before, the psychoeducation can be such an important piece of this, and having those materials to support that can be really useful. So yeah, appreciate you sending those. We definitely will include those in the show notes for the listeners. And it sounds one other piece that maybe you were getting at, and or maybe you said outright and I missed it too, is for a lot of us that are, psychologists, social workers, counselors who are not prescribers, it sounds like probably a really good thing to do is to enhance and cultivate those relationships with prescribers too. When we've got clients that are dealing with substance use disorders, like that partnership seems really important, really vital.
Yeah, I think connections with your prescribers are going to be important, and really having either someone you can direct folks to, or a good list of resources for systems approaches, right? So the VA has the best social workers in the world. That's not opinion, that's fact.
We're on board.
It's so frequent that, in the course of a treatment, you're trying to do cognitive behavioral therapy for substance use disorder, or you're trying to do cognitive processing therapy, and all of a sudden money has become a problem and housing is an issue, and I'm about to get evicted, and how are we still going to do this therapy when I don't have a place to live? There's a lot of other systems that get affected, whether it's the marriage, the work, the relationship, the transportation. All of those things become a component of the treatment because they need to get to our office, or they need to show up to the appointment to be able to continue to work in the therapies, right? So having the support there is huge.
Oh, Mark, you just earned yourself an invite back to the podcast for another episode because you started to answer.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations. You didn't ask for it, but you're getting it. You just an started to answer a question that I'm not going to have time to ask, but I'm so curious about, which is kind of what common challenges come up when you're trying to implement these EBPs in this type of clinic environment. So I'm just gonna whet everybody's appetite with that and see if it's okay if possibly in the future we invite you back in some capacity to talk more about that with us.
Sure, I would love to.
Awesome.
I appreciate that. So, just as we're kind of getting towards the end of our episode today, though, I just wanted to maybe summarize some of the points you brought up because they're really important. We want our listeners to be able to kind of take something with them. We always have a segment at the end we call Actionable Intel. And so, let me see if I get it right. And if I miss anything, please let me know. Corinne, you too. I heard number one, get some training in motivational interviewing or motivational enhancement therapy. That's a great place to start because that's utilizable across a number of scenarios, even if you're not working with folks with substance use presentations, but really, really important there too. There's some really fantastic public health and educational materials out there to have available too, just for our own education, but also to be able to provide to clients as part of psychoeducation. You mentioned also some good training with the American Society for Addiction Medicine in the ASAM, I think is how you said it, ASAM criteria, and that could be really useful too. We'll have some links in our show notes about places you could get that. And then of course, the learning more about harm reduction, meeting our clients where we are, talking about options, talking about how do we kind of meet some of the needs that they have at that time, rather than just taking a complete abstinence approach or no treatment. So, did I miss any others? Corinne, anything else that you heard, or Mark, anything that I missed that you wanted to highlight?
I think I would just like to also hit up Mark for the article that he mentioned by Dr. Oslin talking
Yes.
about MI and PE. So we'll hit you up for that as well. You're not done with us yet,
Absolutely.
Mark.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, this has been a really valuable episode to me. Thank you,
Yes.
Mark, for being
Thank you
with
so
us
much
and
for being here.
educating us a bit on real world practice in the ARU and of course keeping us updated on how awesome Philly's doing.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
All Great. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Always a pleasure to chat with you, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks everybody. We'll talk to you next episode.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
Please feel free to subscribe, like, and share.
Until next time.